this state truly needs to define what good, sustainable hydro is.
Talkeetna residents contemplate another proposed dam on a nearby river. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, September 26th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, making the case for an earthquake warning system in Alaska.
An earthquake early warning system would easily be able to provide tens of seconds before the strongest shaking.
That and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com.
A judge sided with the state of Alaska Friday in a lawsuit challenging the merged campaigns of two candidates in the governor's race. Anchorage Superior Court Judge John Suttuck ruled an emergency order issued by Lieutenant Governor Mead Treadwell that allowed the merger was valid. The lawsuit was filed last week by Steve Strait, an Alaska Republican Party district chair. Strait maintained Treadwell erred in his September 2nd order that allowed Democratic gubernatorial nominee Byron Mallott to join campaigns with independent gubernatorial candidate Bill Walker, and run as Walker's lieutenant governor in the November election. The new ticket is deemed a stronger challenge to Republican incumbent Governor Sean Parnell. After today's ruling, Strait and his attorney Ken Jacobus said they haven't decided whether they'll appeal to the Alaska Supreme Court. Weeks after firing the Adjutant General of the Alaska National Guard, Governor Sean Parnell has asked an official at the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs to resign. Deputy Commissioner McHugh Pierre submitted his resignation Thursday and will leave the department on October 2nd. His resignation letter lists his, quote, tremendous accomplishments at the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, singling out disaster response efforts and the development of a veterans cemetery near Fairbanks. But the letter makes no mention of the Alaska National Guard, which was recently the subject of a scathing federal report. Sharon Lehow, a spokesperson for Parnell, confirmed that the governor asked Pierre to step down, but did not give an explanation for his removal and did not mention the Guard in her statement. The office of the governor declined to comment further on the matter. Michael O'Hare, a deputy director for the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, will be taking over the position on an acting basis. Pierre did not return calls for comment. The proposal for a massive hydroelectric project on the Susitna River is moving forward. The project has generated a lot of opposition in Talkeetna, the closest community to the dam site. Now a private company is proposing a second, smaller hydro project on the Talkeetna River. KTNA's Philip Manning has the story.
So far, the state of Alaska has spent nearly $200 million in studies for a large hydroelectric project on the Susitna River. Now, a private company is starting the process of looking into a smaller project on the Talkeetna River. The company is Northwest Power Service Incorporated. Brent Smith is heading up the Alaska operation and says that this is the first time that NPSI is proposing building a dam, though it has considerable experience in hydropower.
Most all of the projects that Northwest Power Service has been involved with in the past has been to retrofit existing federally owned dams in the lower 48. Where we go in and there's already an existing dam that does not have power generation on it. And so what we do then is go through a licensing process to retrofit that dam and put power on it.
The dam that NPSI is proposing would generate 75 megawatts of power, far less than that proposed by Susitna Watana. It would also have a much smaller footprint than the Susitna project, with a height of 370 feet. Brent Smith says he believes that there's room in Alaska for the diversification of the power grid. He adds that the location of the Talkeetna Dam proposal has a lot to do with proximity to the electrical intertie between Anchorage and Fairbanks. The site is not set in stone, however.
I'm not going to say today that that it's at Talkeetna. I don't know that for sure. What we want to do is take a look at that opportunity.
Brent Smith says that he sees the Talkeetna proposal as a way to start a larger conversation about other power sources. He's a proponent of methods that reduce reliance on fossil fuels. In Smith's eyes, the conversation that is part of any hydro project's public process could help reveal the best option for the rail belt.
My hopes would be we can spend a fair amount of time, or the majority of the time, talking about, is there an opportunity for more renewables in the state of Alaska? Or are we all just going to go to default and go to natural gas and diesel?
Mike Wood is the chair of the Susitna River Coalition, a Talkeetna-based group that opposes the construction of the Susitna-Watonna Hydro Project. He says that just because hydropower does not use fossil fuels to generate electricity does not necessarily mean it's sustainable at large scales.
Overall, this state truly needs to define what good sustainable hydro is at any level.
Wood says that the proposal put forth by Brent Smith and NPSI, while smaller than Susitna-Watonna, still relies on the method of damming a river in order to spin turbines.
And if he wants to start the conversation, if that's what he's saying, he just wants to start the conversation about smaller hydro, I would say personally, I believe he could have started it with a more progressive type of hydropower creator.
In the end, Mike Wood says the Talkeetna Dam proposal will not divert the Susitna River Coalition's efforts in opposing the Susitna-Watonna project. The proposal for the Talkeetna Dam is in its very early phases. On Thursday, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission sent back NPSI's permit request, citing a lack of technical details for the proposed structure. Brent Smith says that he's planning on speaking with local community councils and is open to the prospect of public meetings to discuss non-fossil fuel energy, whether it be in the form of a dam or some other means of generating electricity. In Talkeetna, I'm Philip Manning.
Yesterday's 6.2 earthquake in South Central Alaska struck without warning, because that's what earthquakes do in Alaska. But state seismologist Michael West says it's time for Alaskans to discuss the possibility of an earthquake early warning system.
You can think about it as throwing a rock in a pond, and the waves ripple out at some speed, but it's not instantaneous. If you can detect those ripples before they get to you, like with sensors very close to the source, you can very easily have, you know, seconds, in some cases maybe, you know, a minute or two of forewarning.
The warning time would vary depending on the location and type of earthquake. West says for a quake like the one Anchorage felt yesterday, the warning could only be a few seconds.
If the 1964 earthquake or something comparable were to occur going forward, an earthquake early warning system would easily be able to provide tens of seconds before the strongest shaking. And okay, what does tens of seconds do, really?
It's probably not enough time to evacuate a building, but West says it could be enough for an automated shutdown of a natural gas pipeline.
Stoplights. Turn all the stoplights red to bring traffic to a halt in advance.
Japan's early warning system stopped bullet trains and forced open elevator doors during the massive 2011 earthquake. Switzerland and Mexico also have warning systems. California is building one, but West says there's nothing in development for Alaska. To get such a system, he says, the state would need more seismic stations.
The reason for that's very simple. The closer you have a sensor to the start of the earthquake, the epicenter, the more quickly you can detect it.
It would also require fast data communication lines and a way to deliver useful messages to residents without inducing panic. West says the cost would likely run to the tens of millions.
Let me be honest. Some of this is expensive, and we need to decide whether or not that's a priority for us or not. And I think that's a very logical, a very reasonable discussion to have. My concern is that we're not really talking about it very much.
West was in Washington, D.C. this week to rally support for permanent seismic monitors in northern and western Alaska. They're important for the Alaska Earthquake Center's ongoing data collection, but West says that also be a good first step toward an early warning system. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, one man's journey to reviving an Alaskan native dance group.
She looks to me, she grabs my shoulder and my arm, and she says, real loud, "Not like that."
Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Two of the country's foremost experts in the fight against chronic homelessness highlight the Alaska Coalition on Housing and Homelessness annual conference, which gets underway Monday in Juneau. KTOO's Casey Kelly has more.
This is the first time in recent memory that the capital city has hosted the conference. Scott Schombler is chairman of the Alaska Coalition on Housing and Homelessness, which formed in 1989 to bring together the various nonprofits, social service agencies, and others working with the homeless across the state.
So obviously Juneau being the seat of the legislature, that's key. And then also because there's been fantastic work on behalf of the local community in terms of identifying the needs of the homeless in Juneau. And there's a lot of talk locally about how to promote and make these issues bigger.
Schombler is part of a group advocating for a Housing First project in Juneau. Research shows that Housing First makes it easier to address the underlying causes of long-term homelessness, which often include drug and alcohol abuse and mental illness. The idea is you give the homeless a safe, secure place to live, then focus on why they're living on the streets. Schombler says the coalition is thrilled to have Housing First experts Sam Simbaris and Bill Hobson presenting at the conference. Simbaris founded Pathways to Housing in New York City, and Hobson is executive director of Seattle's Downtown Emergency Service Center.
We invited Sam and Bill to come up and just provide insight onto the whole range of Housing First. You know, I think in some communities in Alaska, we're still at a focal point of kind of understanding what it is.
There are two Housing First facilities in Alaska right now, both former hotels. Karlik Manor in Anchorage is run by the nonprofit Rural Alaska Community Action Program. The Tanana Chiefs Conference runs a facility in Fairbanks. Researchers with the University of Alaska Anchorage have been studying both projects and will present some of their findings to the coalition. Anecdotally, Schombler says both facilities have had success reducing some of the problems associated with homelessness.
The amount of engagement with hospitals, police officers, service patrol pickups has decreased, and there has been obviously a better change in lifestyle for those residents who live there.
Maria Lovishuk is executive director of Juneau's emergency homeless shelter, the Glory Hole, and vice chair of the Alaska Coalition on Housing and Homelessness. Lovishuk says a Housing First project would target an underserved population in the capital city, the chronically homeless.
I don't think that we have any services in Juneau right now that can accommodate these folks properly. And I think that as a community, we are spending a lot of money. And I think that we can just definitely do better. We can save money and we can provide people with a very good housing option.
One thing Simbaris and Hobson will discuss at the conference is how to overcome obstacles and get community buy-in for a Housing First project. Lovishuk says a facility for Juneau's chronically homeless will improve services for those who just need a temporary place to stay.
The folks that we're talking about building this facility for, we are a very, 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 very small segment of the homeless population. I mean, most homeless people in America are now women with children. So, you know, it doesn't solve the homeless problem, but it definitely takes a huge chunk out.
Other topics to be covered at the conference include youth homelessness, the importance of getting accurate data about the state's homeless population and housing stock, and prisoner reentry programs. The conference runs Monday through Wednesday at Centennial Hall. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
State fish and game biologists are in Galena trying to capture three orphaned bear cubs. The state initiated the effort after the cub's mother was reported killed by a local resident. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the state is also working to find the animals a new home.
Department of Fish and Game spokeswoman Kathy Harms says two biologists went to Galena with equipment to capture the black bear cubs.
If they're small enough to be herded into some sort of a fenced area and grabbed and thrown into dog crates, that would be great. If we need to use immobilizing drugs, we have the correct dosage for cubs, we could do that.
Harms says the plan is to transport the 25 to 35-pound bear cubs to the Alaska Zoo in Anchorage for temporary holding, adding that the state is talking with a wildlife care facility in the lower 48 about a more permanent home.
We do have a new entity. It's a rescue place that has applied for permission to hold these cubs for the long term so that they would not have to be euthanized. They have done this with other bears in the past, and we're in the process of investigating their paperwork and making sure that they can provide adequate animal care.
Harms will not name the outfit, citing the review underway for issuance of the required state permit. She says it's rare for the state to deal with orphan bear cubs in the interior, but that it's placed four cubs from South Central this year, adding it's difficult to find homes for black bears because they are more common. She says the state is trying to make that happen because the cubs' chances are otherwise slim.
They would not be able to exist on their own in the wild because other bears and other predators would be so significant, and plus they may not have the experience to know how to den.
The circumstances under which the Galena cubs' mother was shot remain unclear. Lieutenant Justin Rogers with Alaska Wildlife Troopers in Fairbanks is leading an investigation.
Wildlife troopers received a report of an unlawful take of a sow black bear with cubs on September 13th. Currently, we have not identified any suspects.
The state is not actively targeting Galena area bears with any type of predator control measures, but Lieutenant Rogers says the season is open for black bear harvest.
But not for sows that are accompanied by cubs, which are in their first year of life, for black bears, which these cubs are. So I guess the fact that we don't have a complainant reporting that a necessity defense of taking one by a defense of life and property, we're assuming that the sow was killed unlawfully.
Rogers says the three cubs have been spotted numerous times in Galena since their mother was killed. Harm says state biologists have also seen the bears since arriving Thursday. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's business dreams grow for more than 90 years. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. And by
Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska, with health plans designed specifically for Alaska businesses. Learn more at primera.com/newalaska, an independent licensee of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow, Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Aleknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Dave Waldron. This week on AK, learning to dance. Greg Nostein didn't learn traditional Inupiaq dance as a kid growing up in Nome. He was in his 30s when he started studying the dance traditions of his family elders who lived in Wales, Alaska. Now his Anchorage dance group is part of a renaissance in Alaska Native traditional dancing. KNBA's Jacqueline Estes has the story of his personal journey toward tradition.
Good to see
you again. Greg Nostein is hesitant to say he's a dance group leader, but he is a founder of Kingikimute, which means People of the High Bluff, after the original name of Wales, a village in northwest Alaska. King Island is about 45 miles from Wales. Nostein says long before he thought about forming a dance group, the late Paul Tialana of the King Island Dance Group would call on him to dance at performances in Anchorage.
He would look at me and he said, "Dungwana, this is a Welsh song. You got to claim it. Come out here." He said, "Anytime you recognize a song from your village," and of course I didn't know it was from my village at the time, he said, "You're supposed to come out and claim it. You're supposed to dance. That's protocol." If you don't claim it, you're going to lose it.
Nothstein is named after his grandfather, which in the Inupiaq view means his grandfather's soul is supporting him, almost as a reincarnation. The family didn't know where his grandfather was buried, though, until Nothstein was in his early 30s. He says a visit to the grave inspired him. He asked Tialana if he could practice with the King Island dancers.
He just smiled at me, and he said, you know, when I was a boy, we used to travel to your mom's village of Wales, and I was maybe 2-3 years old, and I used to get in the bow of the kayak, and that was a real fun time for us kids. We'd go to your mom's village, and we'd go to the Kajgi. The women were graceful. The men were real powerful singers and drummers. Wow, that was a real wonderful time. Yeah, you bet. You know what? If you go ask those elders who are still alive back in your mom's village, maybe they'll still remember some songs.
More than half the residents of Wales died in the 1918 influenza epidemic, though, so it wasn't clear how many Wales elders would know traditional songs. But Nothstein and his mother and a friend traveled there with a borrowed video camera. Enough elders did know songs. The group used the videos to learn, and the group grew. Nothstein vividly remembers their first performance at the World Eskimo Indian Olympics in Fairbanks some 20 years ago.
And I was really singing my heart out. My aunt was sitting next to me, and I must have missed the cue. It's real easy. You miss cue, and you keep singing the other stanza. And she looks to me. She grabs my shoulder and my arm, and she says, real loud, "Not like that." And it's right in front of everybody, and I'm trying to drum at the same time.
He says the group finished their performance as gracefully as they could.
You have a couple of those experiences. Some people will say, never again, never again, never again. But we said, okay, well, that's the price of admission for reclaiming your songs, you know. I mean, you just have to wade through some of these unknown areas and pitfalls and just keep going.
Nothstein says King Ikemut now regularly performs at different events. They'll soon perform at an elder's birthday party. He says he'd like to see dance groups become an even bigger part of community life.
There were songs that were used to be sung when couples got married, when somebody was successful at a hunt or built a new boat or a baby was born, or there was some significant aspect of life that happened to a whole bunch of people that they wanted to keep in memory. We don't do that as much as anymore.
Heidi Sanungatuk was a professional violinist with the Anchorage Symphony and other orchestras, and always wanted to learn more about the music of her father's people, who are from Wales. She's now a PhD candidate in ethnomusicology. Sanungatuk says dance group members enjoy the music, the dancing, and sense of community, and are making a statement.
People are trying to say, We are here. We're still here. And it's okay to be who we are, rather than, you know, what so many people have experienced in Alaska, which is you're not good enough as a Native person, or the whole colonial thought, which is, you know, get out of the way. We need your land.
At the rehearsal, Nothstein told the 30-some participants it was the last practice before his daughter Raven left for college at Dartmouth. He and his mother and his two children danced the seal hunting dance together, a family favorite. In Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week we're heading to Kaufman Cove on the east side of Prince of Wales Island.
My name's Heather Hedges, and I'm with the city of Kaufman Cove. I do the tourism, gaming, and special events. I think we're somewhere right around 180 people. Definitely decline in tourism. We also have a lot of summer residents that are gearing up to take off or have already taken off. So it's really quiet around here. A lot of people do crafting. We have a lot of people that work for the road, Southeast Road Builders, the bigger companies, the construction companies out here, or logging companies. Not a lot of logging going on at this point. We're supposed to have a sale coming up. However, we've got some lawsuits, I guess, that are pending before that can open up. So most people either take the winter season off, or they enjoy the hunting and fishing still in the winter as well. In August, we have an annual art festival, and that's usually very well received. And so we've just gotten done with that, obviously. And then in November, we're going to have our first annual holiday bazaar. So, and right now we have quite a few vendors. We estimate that we probably had maybe 500 last year at the festival, which was a lot less than the previous year. We had really high winds and rain, which can be a challenge here with tents. So, although with the holiday bazaar, we will be undercover and in the school gym, which is a brand new gym. It was built, I think, 3 years ago, so it'll be well protected. We are looking to expand our library and city offices. However, that's obviously going to be grant funded. And so we are looking to hopefully in the future have something like that go on. However, again, it's grant funded, so it's a matter of whether we get the grants or not. You know, the ocean, the trees, the landscaping is just, it's beautiful here, the natural landscaping. It's definitely a visual for everybody who comes here, visual to look outside. And just the residents here are all so gentle and kind to each other, and it's just a really good family-oriented community.
Heather Hedges works for the city of Kaufman Cove. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. If you want to hear your community feature, send an email to news@alaskapublic.org. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Jacqueline Estes, Ashley Snyder, and Annie Fite. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Dave Waldron.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Philip Manning in Talkeetna, Casey Kelly in Juneau, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ExxonMobil Alaska, where more than 1,000 Alaskan men and women are working on the Point Thompson Project, proving energy lives here.
And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. Ready to quit smoking, using e-cigarettes or other tobacco? Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free, confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online, and now introducing Text to Quit. Text to Quit helps you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message is sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.